My name is Jeff Schlatto. I'm the director of the Tahoe Environmental Research Center, and I'm happy to welcome you all here to our monthly lecture. I'm actually very excited about tonight's topic. It's dealing with Lake Tahoe's nearshore, and the reason I'm so excited is that this project, what you're going to hear about tonight, is really the way I think a lot of projects at Lake Tahoe should take place. Lake Tahoe, whether it knows it or not, is really fortunate because it has a number of research universities, academic institutions that are vested in Lake Tahoe, that do work here, often under difficult conditions, but for the benefit of working in a beautiful place. And we don't often get the opportunity to work hand in hand with each other and with the agencies. And this was a case where this actually happened, with funding from the federal government and working with the agencies who are responsible for the nearshore. Three institutions, Desert Research Institute, University of Nevada, Reno, and UC Davis Tech, worked together, and it was great. It was wonderful, and I think the product that came out is something that was needed. It's not the end of the story. It's really just laying out a plan of where agencies need to go and the potential role that research institutions can play in that. So, as I said, multiple institutions were involved. Dr. Alan Haven led the process. We drew straws, and he got the short straw, and so he had to sort of do a lot of the organizing of this study. But it was great. So we're going to have Alan introducing the whole project, and then we're going to have the different elements of the project described by different speakers. So Christine, the guy Ryan, will be talking about the part that UNR did. Scott Hackley will be talking about the parts that, not the parts of the report, but the area of expertise that UC Davis led. And then Alan, again, will be talking about the DRI roles and responsibilities in the plan. So with that, I should mention that Alan is a graduate of UC Davis. And in the true spirit of Charles Goldman, he was one of the finest students we've ever turned out. Any student that Charles ever had was the finest student. So with that, Alan, thank you.
All right, Alan.
Thank you, Jeff. It really is a pleasure to be back here at Turk. Turk was my home for quite a while, and it was actually my home when I was back in Tahoe City, and the lab was in Tahoe City. And I used to joke that when I worked in limnology on the Orinoco River in Venezuela, in the middle of the jungle, we had a better lab facility there than we did in Tahoe City. But thanks to the work of a lot of fundraisers at UC Davis and the donors here collectively in the community in California and Nevada, you now have this facility here. And we all draw on the incredible capabilities and expertise represented here in the Tahoe Environmental Research Center. And I really appreciate the hand that Jeff and his colleagues have extended to all of us as research colleagues to come here and work with them and to work with partnering institutes to look at some of these really important issues here that are relevant to us locally and regionally. Lake Tahoe is certainly considered one of the premier global environmental assets, and it's our responsibility ultimately to sustain the quality of those assets. And I figure that's part of my job as the director for the Center of Watersheds and Environmental Sustainability at DRI. And it's just great to be working with our colleagues here. And so, as Jeff mentioned, this is not just a project that was done by one research institute. It's the way science is being done these days, and that is it's being done in a very collaborative manner, bringing in multiple researchers with various areas of expertise that work together to address problems that are more complex and require a much broader perspective than the types of issues that we used to deal with 20, 30, even just 10, 15 years ago. So Lake Tahoe's near shore. As you know, UC Davis has been monitoring the water quality and clarity conditions in Lake Tahoe for quite some time, since the mid-60s. And we've used the Secchi disk right here to measure what's happening in terms of changes in lake clarity. And kind of giving a shout out to Dr. Charles Goldman, who really founded limnological studies in Lake Tahoe. I'll show you a slide towards the end of this presentation that shows the long-term trend of Secchi. And it always amazes me that with a very limited amount of data, only a few years of data, he was willing to step out as a scientist and say, things are changing here, they're changing quickly, and they're not changing for the better, and we need to address this problem. And now we're still grappling with some of these same issues. How do we decide when something is so relevant that we can't stand on the sidelines anymore? We have to address these in a very proactive and scientific way. So this is the near shore. This is something now that we're beginning to address more actively, in part simply because we've made a lot of progress in addressing the clarity in the mid-lake. If you've seen recent clarity profiles, you can see that it looks like things are starting to improve. Now, to some extent, the jury may still be out, but I think the consensus amongst the scientists is that the statistical evidence is starting to show that we're actually seeing some improvements in conditions in Lake Tahoe. But the near shore is something that we have never addressed in a very integrated and comprehensive manner. There have been little studies that have been adopted and they've gone on for a couple of years here and there, but there's never been a comprehensive integrated approach to addressing what is happening and what is changing in the near shore. And so we collectively, again, the agencies here in the Tahoe Basin, the scientists knew that this was an issue. We were looking for the opportunity to address this. And with the SNPLM of funding that came in courtesy of the federal government, we were able to address, as part of that program, the SNPLM of program, we were able to address nearshore conditions. And nearshore is important because that's the area that most visitors and residents experience when they come here. They look at what's happening in the lake, they go down, they kayak, they swim. They really have a visceral experience with the nearshore. Not so much with the mid-lake, unless you're kind of high up or you go out on the MS Dixie or another boat and you actually experience the mid-lake, which I recommend. But the nearshore is what most of us know. And there have been, there have been increasing complaints over the years from the public. Even the scientists observed that things are changing, you know, anecdotally. Oh, my grandfather was here, and he remembers that there was no slime on these rocks, you know. And it's like, well, we hear this, but what do we do about it? What does it mean? The problem is that despite this increase in stakeholder interest, it's not a simple question to address. The near shore is much more complex than the mid-lake. And that's why, frankly, most of the work was done in the mid-lake to begin with. The funds were limited, the knowledge about the lake was limited, so we focused on the mid-lake because that integrates everything that's happening around the near shore, everything that's happening in the watersheds comes into the lake, it all gets mixed up, and if you're tracking what's going on in the mid-lake, you can say something relevant about what's happening in the lake. But we didn't know what was going on in the near shore. And anecdotal accounts just aren't sufficient to base any sort of restoration program or monitoring program on. So we developed this project to look at the near shore in a comprehensive and integrative manner. And as Jeff mentioned, it represented the collaborative contributions from multiple research institutions, as well as direct interaction with representatives from all of the water quality agencies working here in the Tahoe Basin, NDEP, Lahontan Water Board, Tahoe Regional Planning Agency, EPA. And so this project really represents the collective effort of nearshore scientists from multiple institutions, as well as technical agency representatives from the various agencies working in Lake Tahoe. This is our project. We finished the project in October of this year, and we've done a few presentations since then. The report was published in October, and it really summarizes what we were able to pull together in terms of information and the assessment and evaluation of that information. So this was not a project designed to go out and collect new data. This was a project that was designed to collect available data and to bring it together in an integrated sense and look at it in terms of what it tells us the lake used to be like, whether it's changing, and what conditions are like now. And to kind of give you the punchline, the fact is we don't have much data on the near shore, so we can't say much about what trends are, but we can give you a snapshot in time in terms of what things are like now. And there's very few metrics or variables that we can actually say anything about in terms of change over time. So we were asked to kind of look at long-term, how things had changed in the nearshore, evaluate existing standards and indicators, and provide a conceptual model as well as a framework for integrated nearshore monitoring. And we did an assessment of existing standards and indicators as well. So the nearshore. What is the nearshore? The nearshore actually is something that that varies from one water body to another. If you go to Lake Erie, the nearshore is defined differently from if you go to like Lake Washington up in Washington State, or even here in Lake Tahoe. There is an existing legal definition for the nearshore, but this wasn't really suitable for our monitoring purposes and evaluation purposes. And so one of the first things we addressed was defining exactly what the nearshore was in terms of the scientific assessment. And so for us, ultimately, we based it on the fact that every summer the lake sets up a thermal structure where you have warm upper waters in the epilimnium separated from cold, deeper waters in the hypolimnium. And there is a point here where the temperatures changes quite dramatically in the thermal climb, and this happens every summer, and the average maximum depth is about 69 feet. And what happens is the waters in the epilimnium tend to mix, and they tend to mix because of the wind, and so all of these waters are relatively homogeneous, okay? They're not homogeneous around the lake. They're not even homogeneous in terms of time in one particular place. But compared to conditions in the hypolimnium, the conditions in the epilimnium tend to be well mixed. And that's why they call the epilimnium typically the mixed layer. So this is a very structural, a very kind of unique and well, not unique, but a very discrete and physical structure in the lake that sets up in the summer. And then in the winter, as the lake cools, everything mixes and resets. And then in the summer, you set up this thermal structure again. So for our purposes, establishing this area here where this warm epilimnetic water intersects with the lake bed and everything above that as the nearshore was a convenient and suitable monitoring framework and assessment framework for the nearshore. And just to make sure, in some cases the lake drops off so precipitously that the nearshore would be just within a foot or two of the rim of the lake, we established, similar to the legal definition, a minimum distance from existing lake level, which is about 350 feet. And so what that looks like here is shown in Incline Village. So we're up, where are we? We're probably right there somewhere, right about here. And so you can see this is the purple line is the 69-foot depth contour. So that's the nearshore. This yellow one is the legal definition for nearshore. It's the 30-foot contour. And you see this just kind of smooths things out a little bit. Over here, though, on the east shore, you can see where that 350-foot horizontal extension reaches out further than than either one of the depth contours, simply because it drops off so quickly. And then over here by Kings Beach, we have quite a shelf, so the nearshore actually extends out some distance from the rim of the lake.
So that's the nearshore. And these are the factors that affect the nearshore. And so a lot of these we're familiar with, and a lot of these same factors actually affect conditions in the mid-lake. And it's things like air pollution that's deposited on the lake surface, urban stormwater runoff, fertilizer runoff, stream runoff, and shoreline erosion. There are a few things that are unique to the nearshore that are different from the mid-lake, though, and that includes things like aquatic invasive species, cross currents, waves. Dr. Schlatel actually has a very good demonstration of the hydrodynamic patterns of currents in the nearshore. And it shows how complex and how variable these conditions are in the nearshore. So all of these things tend to affect not only the nearshore, but ultimately out into the mid-lake as well. And so looking at these things, we can draw a conceptual model. So scientists love this because it represents all the different things that are really important in terms of the nearshore and how they interact, okay? Now, I'm not going to get into the details of this, but it's meant to show you that the nearshore is not a simple environment. It's a very complex, heterogeneous environment. And there's a lot of factors that interact in the nearshore. Some of them we can control, and some of them we can't control. And ultimately, they all affect things like clarity and trophic status, and we'll talk about those here momentarily. So here's some examples of what are uncontrollable drivers. Things like wind and wave action. That's not something that we can control, but it definitely resuspends sediment in the nearshore. Vertical mixing, sunlight, upwelling events, all of these things are important drivers of conditions in the nearshore and contribute to that heterogeneity and that variability that we find in the nearshore. These are examples of controllable drivers, things that we're actually addressing now in the Tahoe Basin through the programs that the agencies have implemented, things like street sweeping of impervious surfaces, stopping erosion and infiltrating the rainfall, reducing vehicle emissions, limiting the use of fertilizer so we don't have so much fertilizer running off into the lake, and trying to control the aquatic invasive species introductions. Really big problem here now, not just in Tahoe, but globally. All right, very briefly, I wanted to talk about existing standards. When we started, one of the primary reasons the agencies wanted us to do this project is because they had over 60 different standards, existing standards, that were potentially relevant to the nearshore. And it's like, how do you sort through those? Which of those are really important? Which of those do we address? Which ones are superfluous to the nearshore? And our job was to look at these and assess those in terms of their relevance to the nearshore. And so we sorted them into different categories because sometimes they were similar coming from different agencies. And we ended up with about 38 different categories that were distinct. And then we looked at these in terms of whether they were relevant or not to the nearshore, not only for monitoring, but also for management. And so some of these are important and some are relevant. And the ones that are important and relevant, then we carry forward as a subset to help define the basis for monitoring. And I'm not going to get into, you know, which of these were and weren't important, other than to say that ultimately these 10 metrics right here are the ones that represent the most important characteristics in the nearshore. And they contribute to things like lake clarity, the lake trophic status. Lake trophic status is how fertile a lake is, how much algae will grow in that water. The community structure, what lives there? What types of plants, what types of animals? And then ultimately conditions for human health as well. Whether, you know, there's any harmful microorganisms, pathogens, toxins. And so these are the metrics that are most important to monitor in the nearshore. These are the metrics that are considered response metrics. These are the ones that are particularly sensitive to changes in the nearshore because of what's happening in the watershed, in the airshed, or species introductions. And so they're going to be an early warning indicator, the canary in the mine, if you will, for changes in the nearshore. And they allow you to track trends and to say something about status. And ultimately, then, these all lead up to what we want to see in terms of desired condition in Lake Tahoe. And so those same 10 metrics are represented here, just kind of showing you pictorially how those things are related. And so at this point now, we're going to talk a little bit about each one of these indicators, because if you notice back here, we had these 10 metrics derived from these existing standards, and each of those metrics then contributes to what we consider kind of a cumulative indicator, and then ultimately each one of those is evaluated as an indicator of condition in the nearshore. And we're going to have Christine Nagai speak to you about trophic status, in particular about phytoplankton, and about community structure, aquatic community structure. She's going to talk about macroinvertebrates and fish. And then after Christine, Scott Hackley, who works here at UCD, he's been a long-term scientist with TURC, is going to talk a little bit about the trophic status indicators, in particular about parafine, because parafine is the one metric that we actually have a fairly decent record of monitoring data for. And then I'll come back and kind of wrap up with a little discussion about nearshore clarity. So at that point, Christine, if you want to go ahead and... Oh, it's never been on? Can you hear me back there?
Has it started yet?
Hello, everyone.
So, as Alan said, I'm going to... Whoa, it's really loud. I'm going to talk about the nearshore community structure indicator. And the work that I'm going to present is I didn't do it all by myself. My PI, Dr. Sudhin Chandra, my colleague Manny Harries, and Tim Caldwell have all put in time to put this part of the report together. So we touched on a little bit about what is community structure, right? Community structure essentially describes what lives in a community. So we have plants, major plants, we have insects, macroinvertebrates, and animals, fish, in this case. And to talk about measuring community structure changes, we need to introduce the idea of biological integrity. This term first came out from the Clean Water Act in 1972, and essentially what this is a measure or a comparison of sort of how pristine an ecosystem is in terms of what's the current quality of an environment compared to its natural original state. And in the core of this idea is community. What makes up a community? We need to find out who lives in the community and how do they interact? What are the functions of these community members? How do they perform? So in this case, if you look at changes of the community structure, you can infer what's going on or what level of integrity an ecosystem is at, the health and condition, essentially. So who lives in Lake Tahoe, in the nearshore of Lake Tahoe? A lot of exciting things goes on, biologically speaking. We have algae, zooplankton, we have macrophytes, which Scott's going to talk about. We have benthic invertebrate, crayfish is part of that, even though it's big. It's in the same category as these little insects at the bottom. We have native minnows, which are generally the smaller fish, and then we have the big predator, which are our desirable species that are naturalized, so our trout species, and then we also have aquatic non-native species, for example, like this evil largemouth bass. So we know who lives in Tahoe. Now we want to know how do they interact, right? That will tell us, in a way, show you what the relationship is going on in nearshore and also reflect what's going on in the environment. There's a lot of arrows going on. This is mostly reflecting where the energy is going, right? If you look from the bottom, you have the algae, the primary producer, feeding the primary consumer, zooplankton, and some of the benthic invertebrates and the macro invertebrates, such as crayfish, and then you move on to the second level, the secondary consumers, which are our fish, and the smaller fish, and also bigger fish, which these might be considered tertiary consumers, and then we have us, right? These big species have recreational value to us. It can be our food, and it also can be, occupies a lot of our playtime living here. The community structure indicator, we are primarily focusing on these metrics. So we're focusing on the secondary and the tertiary consumers in this community. First of all, we can look at benthic invertebrates. The reason why we're looking at these is if you think of in a community, these are sort of relatively the long-term residents in the area. So if you've lived in Tahoe for 20 years, you notice that the near shore has changed. So by looking at what's going on with them, you can hopefully tell what's happened throughout this time series that we will look at. But the key thing is, what Alan has pointed out, is we really only have snapshot records of these. For example, benthic invertebrates, really the structured, high-quality studies have been done in the 60s, and then it was done around 2000. So there's a 40-year gap. What is benthic invertebrate? Right? I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with this picture, springtime, summertime, all these midges flying in front of your face. They're actually really important members of the community, and a lot of these aquatic invertebrates actually live most of their life cycle in water, and then they emerge out into terrestrial. So they're considered aquatic invertebrates because part of their life cycle is in water. When you look at benthic invertebrate, looking at the composition, distribution, and abundance, you can group them in sort of two general groups. One's considered sensitive species. In this case, these are pictures of Tahoe stonefly and the blind amphipods, and they are endemic to Lake Tahoe, so you can only find them in Tahoe and nowhere else. They're the true locals. And they're really sensitive to environmental change, and I think some of the audiences have actually helped collect some of these. The Tahoe stonefly primarily live in deeper water, so they're not really in the near shore, but I just want to show that we do have sensitive species that are unique to Tahoe. And this is a picture that's really cool, I just want to talk about it. This is a female stonefly, and we just found that they actually carry their own eggs and have live birth. And it's apparently told by my colleague that it's very rare in the insect world, so that's really cool. So we have the sensitive species, we also have general species, which are the midges that flies around in your face. They are actually used in a lot of places to measure biological integrity because there are a lot of species and they range in their tolerance to stress, to environmental disruption. So by looking at the composition of the different species of midges, you can sort of judge what condition your lake is at. So you have midges that prefer pristine, clean water, like the general impression you get of Lake Tahoe, oligotrophic lake. You have midges that are more generalist, so they can withstand a variety of environment. And what we've found by just those two snapshot studies from the 60s and in the 2000s is that the composition back in the 60s used to be mostly species that are prefer pristine oligotrophic environment. And now you have the composition completely switched to more generalist species. And these sensitive species, their population has dropped 99%. So that's the benthic invertebrate. So if you look at those, the composition of those and the distribution, you can tell what trophic status the lakes are at. Now we have the mobile consumers. What are considered mobile consumers? Fish and crayfish. And why are they considered mobile? Because they move a lot. And when they move around, they use different microhabitat, right? They live in Kings Beach for a little bit, move to Incline, and then go to South Lake. And what you can tell from their structure is that where do they prefer to go? And maybe those places are in better conditions. Or what has happened to their numbers? Maybe something has changed in the environment. And here we have The crayfish, which is a non-native species that were intentionally introduced, we have native minnows, and then we have the top predators. And part of the top predators also involve the aquatic invasive species, right? If you think about near shore, it is the entry point for aquatic invasive species that are coming from outside of the area. It's usually transported by humans, and where, how did a human enter the lake? Through the near shore. So by monitoring the near shore fish and crayfish community, you're not only just going to be looking at the native species and be like, oh, I don't know what that is, so I'm not going to record that. You'll see species that you don't recognize, they're not in the area, and that will help you detect or early detection of aquatic invasive species invasion or introduction. So what would we look at? Composition, distribution, and abundance. And essentially what we're focused on would be monitoring the native species population. From the snapshot study that we have done in 2009 compared to the 90s, about 60% of the sites that we have monitored have shown a decrease. And when you monitor these are actually a lot of times food for our desirable species like our trout, right? So if there's a decrease in these numbers, that's showing that they're not getting food. And of course there are native species, so if you have a decrease in native species, is that something going on? Is there aquatic, is there invasive or non-native species taking up their spots? And then the monitoring of aquatic invasive species. So we have bass, crappie, and the famous goldfish here. These species are not desirable because they are either competitors or they're predators to our native species. So monitoring them is also important. And then we have the crayfish. What the function of crayfish in this ecosystem is still to be determined, but based on research from other species, from other places compared to what we have here, and also, again, snapshot studies, we have shown that there is about a 60% increase in number of crayfish in general in the lake, even though it seems like it's hard to harvest. That's what I've heard from the harvester. What they do is they're a very effective consumer. They're essentially your lawnmowers for the lake. So they can consume large amount of macrophytes, which are habitat for those sensitive species, for those cute little insects that live in the bottom of the lake. And also they are preferred desirable food for largemouth bass. When we open these stomachs, a lot of times we find crayfish. So they're supplementing non-native species, and they are disrupting native species. So monitoring their distribution and abundance is also important to help us figure out what is going on in the near shore.
And are crayfish introduced?
Crayfish was introduced intentionally as a food source for our desirable species that are also non-native, but they're desirable. And I think I'm about to stop about the macrophage.
John Ruder, who started the parapiton work with Stan Lowe, and they started that in the early 1980s. And parapiton is, parapiton is the attached algae. It's the algae that grows on the rocks along the near shore And it's a real visible indicator of change in the lake. It responds to nutrient inputs, nitrogen and phosphorus. And so when you get the real heavy inputs of growth along shore, that's an indicator that there might be a pretty good source of nutrient inputs. And there's many other factors that contribute to the growth of periphyton. And so back in the 1960s, it was one of the most visible indicators of change that Dr. Goldman recognized. And so he started some periphyton monitoring in the early 70s offshore. And then Stan Loeb and John started their pretty intensive monitoring in the early 1980s. And this just shows different areas where it grows and different types of algae. Okay, so again, it has a long history of study, so there's a pretty good database that's been developed. We currently have 9 routine monitoring stations that I'll get out and monitor with Brant Allen, and we'll go out 5 times a year. We'll monitor pretty intensively during the spring. We'll monitor 3 different times. That tends to be the time where you get the peak spring growth, and then we'll monitor the lower baseline growth at other times of the year. So the sites with the stars are our routine sites, 9 sites that we monitor 5 times a year. And then the red dots are additional sites where we'll go out during the peak periphyton growth and assess the level of growth relatively rapidly during that peak period, so we get a good idea of what the distribution of periphyton is around the lake. Okay, so in different areas, you'll see different amounts of growth. It isn't uniform around the lakeshore. This shows Sugar Pine Point, a rock or a boulder offshore, and often there's not a lot of growth there. It's off of a state park, which is a natural area. And the stream, General Creek, which comes in there, is more of a natural type of stream. So this site tends to be a little bit more pristine. Going back in history, back in the early 80s, however, there was a period where it was a little bit heavier growth. Then this is where you get into the really heavy stuff, and this tends to grow along the northwest shore from Dollar Point on over to Pineland. And so this is a site, it's actually just a little bit north of Ward Creek. And this is a type of algae called Gonthamias. It's a tiny diatom. It's called a stock diatom. And it's a tiny algae cell that grows on the end of a thick stalk. And all those stalks wind together to create this tangled, feathery mat of algae. And it gets very heavy in certain areas in the spring. So we'll monitor there. Ward Creek is one of our highest sites where we get the heaviest levels of growth. And our routine site, Pineland, it is also very heavy there in Tahoe City. So periphyton responds to inputs of nutrients, nitrogen and phosphorus. Just like you put fertilizer on a lawn, both human-induced nutrients and natural-induced inputs of nutrients cause the algae to grow along the shore. And so there's many possible sources, both man-caused and natural sources. Some of the man-caused are, there's old septic leach fields in certain parts of the lake close to the shore. Those may still be releasing nutrients. Stormwater inflows from the urban areas, they drain off the roadsides and carry nutrients directly into the lake. Stream flows, fertilizer usage, that can both run off the land and also enter into the groundwater and enter into the lake that way. Identifying different sources of nutrients through part of the both the TMDL efforts and the EIP restoration efforts. And this is an area where we're trying to assess what are the sources of nutrients and other causes of the periphyton growth, and hopefully, ultimately, parse out the different contributions of the different causes of periphyton growth, identify the major ones. Okay, so this shows some of the average, or the peak, I think this one is a peak growth per year at four different areas around the lake. Two of the areas, Pineland and Tahoe City, are areas where you have more urban development and more of a history of development. And so those are shown in the yellow and the green, and those tend to show higher periphyton growth. Sugar Bottom Point is an area more pristine and tends to be less, you get less periphyton growth. And Zephyr Point on the southeast shore also tends, you tend to get less growth, a little bit less heavily developed. Okay, one of the things that we do in the spring, John Reuter came up with what's called a rapid assessment technique to monitor quickly the levels of periphyton along the shore. And what it is, it's called the periphyton biomass index. And it's basically assessing what the percent coverage in a certain area is with periphyton, and multiplying that times the filament length, or the height of the algae above the rocks. And so you multiply the height in centimeters times the percent coverage area. And we do this at a set depth of 0.5 meters in the near shore. And so we'll come up with a periphyton biomass index at each site, which is a level estimate of the level of growth. And then we'll do that at 40 to 50 sites around the lake. And then we'll pick out maybe 30% of those. We'll also assess the periphyton chlorophyll A, which is a measure of biomass. And so we have a physical measure, then a rapid assessment of the levels. And so back in 2009 to 2011, John developed a survey, which we had out here at Turk, where he had these photos placed up on the wall. The levels of, or the biomass index, which are these numbers here, weren't there. So it's just the photos. And then we had a paper survey where people could tell us which level they felt was aesthetically not pleasing. Under which level would you feel comfortable getting in the water and swimming around? I mean, it wouldn't bother you too much. And then if you were doing a surface water sport, which level would you be comfortable with? Or which would be just, you know, totally unacceptable to see in the Tahoe near shore. So behind the scenes, we knew these numbers for each of these photos. And so it goes from very, very low growth on through moderate growth to a high level of periphyton biomass index. And so we got over 100 responses, and then John did statistics and looked at various responses. And so what he came up with is that most people found the acceptable condition would be a periphyton biomass index of 0.5. So that would be between these two biomass indexes there. That's what most people felt was aesthetically acceptable, and that's what they like to see. One of the, if you, let's see, general aesthetics, avoid area, general aesthetics, let's see, okay, trying to figure this out. So this one here, avoid water contact. So if you if you're using water, you're wading in it, you're swimming, snorkeling or whatever, a level a little bit higher than 0.5 would be acceptable, anything below that. And if you're using it for kayaking, other surface water sports, then a much higher level would be acceptable. You're seeing the attached algae down on the bottom. And when it gets very nasty, above a level of one, it appears that people still find it okay. But the avoid area general water or general aesthetics, I think just the whole general picture, if it get if people found 0.6 would be acceptable. So okay, so this survey just kind of points out that we have both scientifically collected data that we're using to assess the level of periphyton growth. We have hard numbers for the peak spring growth and periphyton growth through time. So we have actual, the scientific data. And then we can use surveys to assess the level of periphyton growth that is acceptable to the public. And so we can use both scientific numbers and also the surveys to help contribute to gain insight into what are desirable and undesirable conditions for periphyton growth in the near shore. So again, the survey, John used statistics to determine what the acceptable levels were, and in the future, if we come up with standards or desirable conditions for periphyton growth in the near shore, we can incorporate your opinions and the scientific metrics. Okay,
Scott.
Yeah.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
In my experience over the years, I've seen more periphyton growing on the eastern or on the western shore of the lake.
Yeah.
Less on the eastern shore, more in the shallow environments, which is consistent.
Right.
And much less in the deeper environments, say Rubicon Wall. There's very little growth down there.
Right.
Have you guys discussed why that might be, or have you found that to be consistent with what we're seeing? On the
yeah. Water? No, that's a good description of it. We get much heavier growth along the northwest portion of the lake. And we think it's due to a combination of many different factors. We think nutrients are probably the primary source of that growth. And along the west shore, you have a lot more precipitation, so you have a lot more runoff coming in. So it's carrying a lot more water and a lot more nutrients.
And the currents flow that way in the summertime. Is the nutrient feeding of this being pushed? Do you guys know? Have you?
One of the things we'd like to look at more is how the currents impact the nearshore periphyton growth.
Okay.
There's big gyres in the lake, and then there's smaller currents along shore. So where that water is derived from, how it's moving along shore, and other things are the stream inputs, urban inputs, and on the east shore you don't have that heavy precipitation, you don't have a lot of stream inputs. Groundwater, you don't have a lot of groundwater sources over there. The algae varies with depth on the rock, so up in the upper part of the rock you have a rapid colonizing algae, can take advantage of changing nutrient conditions and grow really fast. And then down below you have a different community, it's called a blue-green algae. And it's like a brownish encrusting algae, which is really slippery. So when you get the lower lake years, where the lake level draws down, sometimes you'll get that blue-green algae right near the surface. And on the east shore, during those drought years, sometimes it will get pretty heavy over there. You'll get that blue-green algae, and then a green filamentous algae can come in on top of that. And, so the way the lake level fluctuates also plays into how the algae Gross.
I'm going to cut in here so we can finish up this, and then we'll take questions afterwards.
Okay. Thanks.
I would like to point out that there is considerable value in having long-term researchers here in the Tahoe Basin, because people like Scott and Christy can address your questions specifically in terms of their experience and their knowledge working here in the Tahoe Basin. So that's something to be valued, and that's a very very significant local asset that I think we don't appreciate sufficiently. I'm going to finish up with our third indicator here, which is water clarity, nearshore water clarity. And so this is the one where we're looking at turbidity, light transmission, the amount of chlorophyll or suspended phytoplankton in the water. This is how people kind of think about the nearshore. If you remember that first slide we showed, it's beautiful, clear water in the nearshore. That's what we expect to see in Tahoe. And when we don't, we're somewhat disillusioned. So what we'd like to do is continue to sustain that quality of clarity in the nearshore. The question is, where are we at now and how do we do that? One of the main causes of loss of clarity, we've heard about the fertilizers and the nitrogen and the phosphorus and how those actually cause algae to grow, whether it's the attached algae on the rocks, it's periphyton, or it's suspended phytoplankton. Those contribute to loss of clarity. That's when your water is getting green. But there's also the contribution of fine sediments, and those are the very fine particles that actually contribute significantly to the loss of clarity in the mid-lake. They also contribute to the loss of clarity in the nearshore. And that's because it's coming off of urban surfaces, our roadways, our impervious surfaces, where we get this kind of water. These are samples that were actually collected out in various stormwater runoff sites that flow into the streams or into the lake and then cause a decrease in clarity in the lake and stream water. And you can see here, I mean, there's very little difference between stream water and Lake Tahoe water. It's hard to measure those differences, okay? You can't tell the difference just looking at it in a small sample like this, unless you have very sophisticated equipment. And so we go out with a boat that's set up with a bow-mounted sampler that actually collects samples from the nearshore and pumps it through the cabin here and through instrumentation that measures the amount of light transmissivity and the turbidity of the water and the chlorophyll in the water to tell us something in terms of the actual quantification of what the nearshore clarity is like and how that changes spatially and temporally around the lake. And this is what it looks like. And so you can see here, for example, in terms of light transmissivity, that there are very localized places where you do see these decreases in clarity associated with things like nutrient inputs that also cause the periphyton growth, as well as fine sediments coming off with stormwater runoff from our urbanized areas. And they cause a loss of clarity in different parts of the lakeshore. And this is a very valuable tool, because just like looking at the periphyton now, we can look at places that actually are showing decreased clarity or degradation over time and see those and pinpoint those as hot spots. Those are areas where we have problems. We want to go back and look up into the watershed or look into the nearshore, see what factors are contributing to the deterioration in those areas. So one of the things that got me thinking about nearshore was how to establish some sort of a standard. We had long-term data from the mid-lake in terms of lake clarity with the Secchi disk. So we were able to say something about, you know, what we wanted to see in terms of lake clarity in the mid-lake. But how do we do that for the nearshore? We don't have this record of long-term clarity monitoring in the nearshore. We've only been doing it for a few years. We didn't have the equipment to do it much sooner. And so we have to figure out how to establish some sort of reference condition. You know, what is it we want to see? And it's sort of like what Scott was showing in terms of the periphyton, for being very clean, very clear, and nice, to being something that's just like it's a picture out of the monster from the Black Lagoon. You know, I wouldn't want to get into that water over there by Sunnyside. That's above my PBI threshold, I'm sorry. So, you know, we need to find and decide kind of collectively as a community, on what level of condition we're willing to accept here in the Tahoe Basin for all our near-shore conditions, whether it's for parafighting, whether it's for clarity. And to do that, we also need some sort of sense of like where we're at, maybe where we could be or where we were historically. And I decided, well, okay, there is a way we could do that. Because Mark Twain was here, all right? Mark Twain was here in 1861, one of my favorite authors, all right? And he describes floating around the near shore in northeast Lake Tahoe in the summer of 1861. And the water was so singularly clear that the boat seemed floating on air. Guess what? It was even 80 feet deep. Every little pebble was distinct, every speckled trout, every hand's breadth of sand. The water was not merely transparent, but dazzlingly, brilliantly so. 1861. This is before the Comstock logging. Mark Twain had the good fortune to be here before any of this change happened in the Tahoe Basin. He caught it in his pristine state. But you go, all right, Mark Twain. Great author, but boy, did he ever exaggerate, you know? He was always making up things. That frog never jumped that far, right? Well, okay. I think, you know, if you want to talk about nearshore clarity, he's talking about something like this or like this. I think he's referring to something more like this. And if you read his book, he actually sent us a message from 1861, because he didn't only talk about the nearshore clarity right here. He also talked about the lake depth, talked about the distance around the lake, talked about the altitude above sea level. All right, this is what he wrote in Roughing It. This is what we know now. This is what the difference is. He was within 20% on each one of those other metrics that he documented in that book. Where did he get his name? Mark Twain. Where did that come from? Right? Right. It's a Lensman sounding depth of 2 fathoms. And he was a steamboat pilot. He needed to know how deep the river was when he was cruising upstream in the Mississippi over shoals and shallows. And so depth was really important to him. And when he says he was fishing and he could see that the fish at 80 feet was not taking his bait, and that's what he says in his book, it would be very easy for him to measure out what 80 feet is, all right? I think he was sending us a message by giving us these accurate numbers about how far he really could see in the near shore in Lake Tahoe. He could see 80 feet. This is 40 feet, all right? Is this what he was describing? I don't think so. That means we've lost over 50% of our clarity in the near shore, more than we have in the mid lake, and that's because conditions in the near shore are different, all right? I'm not saying we're ever going to get back to 80 feet, but where do we want to be? All right, that's what we need to decide collectively. Where do we want to be in terms of conditions in Lake Tahoe, both in the mid lake and in the near shore? And then drive the policies, drive the actions that will ultimately help us achieve those goals. And so the point is that quantifying these numbers, quantifying these factors, is really important. Mark Twain knew it, all right? He gave us real numbers. He knew that all the way back in the 1800s. And if we can't be out there measuring these things on a regular basis and documenting where we are, where we're going, what progress we've achieved, then we're not doing our job. And we need your help to do that job, all right? Do you have any idea how hard it has been for UC Davis to sustain this long-term record of Secchi measurements in the Midland? And only because we have collected that data over the long term can we now begin to say that we're actually making progress. We wouldn't be able to say this if we weren't making these measurements, because you wouldn't see it. You would not see the difference. Just like we don't see the difference in the nearshore. The difference in the nearshore has been so dramatic, and yet we don't really see it because there's just been this incremental change over time. And we hear anecdotally, wow, you know, when my grandfather was here, it wasn't like this. And we kind of just absorb that information. We don't quite know what to make of it because it's not quantifiable. You need numbers. And so getting those numbers is critical to establishing a long-term monitoring and management program. And that gets me to my final slide here, which is talking about a monitoring program. In terms of manufacturing processes, we use things like quality control charts. And so this is Walter Schuart and Edwards Deming. And these were the fathers of modern process control in terms of manufacturing processes. So if you remember back in the 70s or so, the Japanese were building cars. They were building the little Civics and the little Toyotas, and it's like no one really wanted to buy them, and because they weren't any good, right? And then Toyota's going, well, we're not selling very many of these because they don't hold up. Let's bring this guy over here, Walter Deming, who was a colleague of Schuart, and let's get him to teach us about quality control. And what he taught them was you need to track your processes. When you're manufacturing something, you need to determine where you are in your process. Are you outside of the range you need to be, or are you inside the range? You're never going to have everything right on the line because there's this natural variability, even more so in natural environments. Natural environments are hugely heterogeneous and a lot of variability. And so you can't just say, we're going to hit this target and we're just going to stay there, all right? You're going to have a lot of variability. And the only way to know whether you're achieving your goals and meeting your targets is to introduce this kind of quality control process. Well, that is exactly what UC Davis has done with their long-term second-disc clarity monitoring program. They have established this ability to tell us whether we're staying within our specifications for quality control in terms of our environmental management of the Tahoe Basin. All right, final point is that is a monitoring program, and we need to sustain these monitoring programs, and we do not have the funding to do it because it is not sexy, all right? Everyone wants to see capital projects. It's a lot better to, you know, put in a bike trail and do something that's visible, because we can all point to it and say, hey, look, we've done this, right? But you can't actually say what's going on in terms of achieving your goals in terms of like near-shore clarity or mid-lake clarity unless you're going out measuring it and monitoring changes over time. And that's what we need to do here in the Tahoe Basin. Now, to the credit of the Tahoe agencies, they actually are already implementing aspects of this nearshore program. So we've developed the report, we developed the recommendations for a very cost-effective but comprehensive integrated nearshore monitoring program. And the agencies are really struggling to implement this and to investigate some of these hotspots in the nearshore where we know conditions are particularly bad. Why are they bad? And so we need to help them do that. Write to your congressman, write to your representatives. Start a booster program, help us out, because we need to implement these programs to really tell us where we're going and if we're achieving our objectives here in the Tahoe Basin. And it's not as sexy as finding the Titanic, but it's what's going to allow us to ultimately say whether we're retaining the qualities of Lake Tahoe that we are collectively responsible for. All right, thank you very much.
What role does the granite that's surrounding this lake for millions of years, what part of this lake, because I've been here since the mid-80s, I'm a docent at Thunderbird Lodge, so I've been on the lake a lot, and I know this lake being millions of years old, we have all this granite. What role has the granite played in the clarity of this lake? I assume a huge role.
Well, granite...
Just common sense wise, I'm just used to coming from a common sense. We see this lake, millions of years, we have all this granite surrounding us. I assume it acted as a filter to keep the nutrients and nitrates out so there wouldn't be a lot of algae. And one other thing I want to bring up is over by Rubicon, why it's so clear, that drop-off is about 1,000 feet. So I'm assuming that's why it's a little clearer at that depth from shore, from the time you jump off the shore, it's 1,000 feet, so there's really nothing to catch on over there.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious.
Yeah, so 2 points. One, the granites are definitely, granite basins are known to be relatively infertile in terms of supporting algae growth, mm-hmm. And in terms of contributing fine sediments to the water. But that's why your glacial lakes, your glacial cirque lakes tend to be so clean. If you go up hiking in Desolation Wilderness, those lakes are really pretty clean, and that's why, in large part. I mean, you still get atmospheric deposition coming in, but in terms of runoff from the landscape and the percolation through the subsoils, you don't get as much as you would in other lake systems, in other basins.
Right.
And then, yeah, certainly in terms of proximity of the deep lake to the near shore, you get more mixing just because you, even though you have that thermal isolation, there's still upwelling events and there's things that contribute to kind of mix those waters along the edge. So places where you have very steep drop-offs typically will be better transparency, less parafine, unless there's something contributing directly online at that location.
Of course, it's something that we are aware of.
Yeah.
Okay.
And a question, this is primarily for Scott, but so Scott, there's a one point you had was possible sources for nutrients. What was absent, I thought, was possibly atmospheric deposition, so I wonder if you can speak to that. And then also absent from the periphyton data was anything with South Lake. So is the substrate in South Lake, or is it the monitoring locations?
Atmospheric deposition does contribute a lot of nutrients to the lake. A lot of nitrogen, I think over 50% of the nitrogen comes in directly through atmospheric deposition. So a lot less phosphorus. So the algae tend to like both nitrogen and phosphorus. So you're getting, yes, a lot of nutrient inputs with atmospheric deposition, but maybe not so much phosphorus, which they like. And then the substrate types, definitely they do vary around the lake. Over in the northwest portion of the lake, I think you have more volcanics, and so the mineral composition is different, and may affect the phosphorus inputs over on the northwest portion. And down around the south shore, you have more sandy areas, more sandy substrate, and it's not a good substrate for periphyton to attach to. So down along the south shore, during the summer, you'll often see this rolling type of bright green algae, and that's called metaphyton. And it just kind of accumulates. It may come off the vegetation or the limited substrate that's down there and then roll along the bottom. And it can also be quite nasty at times for people using the south shore, and but it's different than the attached algae. Yeah,
you mentioned earlier, you guys mentioned that you had some real early snapshot data, and I was wondering if the algae data you presented, the first bin was 2000, so I was wondering if you had any, like, you know, decades old snapshot of what that condition
I think actually Bob Richards, you were involved in periphyton studies in the 70s, and they did by scuba, they placed out these glass cylinders out offshore, and so they were able to monitor different areas and different levels of periphyton growth offshore, and I think they found that it was higher off of some of the stream areas, like Ward Creek and some of the other areas. And then when Stan Loeb and John Reuter came in the 1980s, they started looking at the natural rock substrate along shore. And I think I brought an actual sampler here. It's they're able to use these periphyton samplers, basically a couple of syringes, and use a brush and scrape the algae right off the rock and collect it. And so they looked at many different areas and found again that Pineland, Ward Creek area was high back in the early 1980s. And so we do have baseline data going back then from the rock substrate.
Okay. Do you have a feeling of how it compares now to then?
Off the Pineland area, over the past 10 years, it looks like there's an increasing amount of growth. But if you go back to the early 1980s, there was a period of high growth back then, too. So it's a little bit hard to say there whether it's increased through time, though the recent trend is that it is increasing. But there is a, Tahoe City was showing a little bit of a decreasing trend, and those are the two that come to mind. But the parafilm data hasn't been continuous. We went through about 1985, and then we stopped. And we picked it up again in 89 through 92 and did some monitoring. And then from 2000 on, it was pretty consistent. So a good record. So we do have data from back then. Yes.
First, I want to thank you for your work and for providing some quantifiable data and insights as to what's going on in the lake. My question is particularly with regard to the parafilm. Do we know about either what influences the bioproductivity in terms of how that either is a nutrient for anything else in the community, in the lake, or is it just sort of a sink for the resources?
That's a good question. Sudeep Chandra and other folks are looking at the crayfish, and I think the crayfish do feed on the parafilm quite a bit. And The periphyton takes up the nutrients, the crayfish eat the periphyton, but then what happens to those nutrients? I think the crayfish excrete it back into the water, so it's kind of a cycle. As far as being a habitat for the small midges and things, they also would act on the periphyton and maybe in some areas keep it in check. But can you say anything more about it, Christine, or as far as?
Well, I guess with this presentation as well is that we have to look at the whole ecosystem as a connective food web, right? So the parafilm is related to crayfish is often considered an ecosystem engineer because it's a mobile consumer and it takes the nutrients from the plants or the algae transfer it to itself, and then in some cases it feeds the aquatic invasive fish, which then that creates a new source, or it transfers the source to other species. So obviously this is all connected.
Is the network map that was shown, I forget who showed it, is that in the report from October?
The conceptual model, really big, it is. It is in the 130 pages.
400
pages. Yeah.
The bulk of the report is actually focused not so much on what we talked about, but on the evaluation of the specific 10 metrics that we looked at.
Alan, question?
We got a few other people back here. Let's give a couple people a chance and we'll come back. Cindy?
So just thinking about the nutrients in nearshore, I mean, LPEMP's been doing stuff for a long time. Is the boat surveys you showed kind of filling in the gaps? Because, you know, there's a lot of sources in between each one of those creeks, you know, there's developments, there's ditches and stuff. And so is the boat doing that job, or is there other sampling needed?
For the clarity?
More for identifying where more nutrients are coming in outside of just stream sources.
Yeah, so that's an important point. We are not actually measuring inputs to the lake. Okay. The circuits around the lake in the near shore are done at about the 6 foot contour, 6 to 12 foot contour. So they do reflect these localized inputs. However, we are not directly measuring those localized inputs. That is a subsequent step. A follow-on step, when you identify places that are particularly outside of what you would expect to see or they're showing a trend beyond what is desired, then you would look at what's contributing to that
in that area. This also links up
sources.
Yeah, for sources. I mean, very important point. It's not this program in no means is simply just to go out and look at what's happening in the lake. It's actually to identify opportunities to go and do something about it. And but you don't just go and kind of shoot a shotgun at the map and hope that these restoration projects you're doing in their collective effect will provide benefit. You actually want to target your restoration projects to mitigate the largest impacts. And so this gives us an opportunity, whether it's with the Periphyton or the Clarity or even with the community structure, it allows us to identify opportunities for high-value restoration projects. And it links up with other programs. There's the Regional Stormwater Monitoring Program and the stream monitoring programs, which also contribute that information and then ultimately link directly then to the results that we're getting in the nearshore. Now, I have to mention that outside of Periphyton, and even for Periphyton, this so-called monitoring program does not exist yet. What we're showing you is just the kind of collective bits of data that we've put together in a way that we can provide you a sense of kind of a complete picture. But this isn't because there's been any funded program to go out and do this on a regular basis. That's what we need. And that's why I can't stress enough that what you have here with UC Davis and with UNR and with DRI is a very unique collaboration and a very high value team and set of institutions that can provide that kind of information. And that doesn't happen in most places. And we generally do it pretty cost effectively as well. But programs like this seminar series, wouldn't even happen outside of the support of our local community. So we really need your support to kind of keep these programs going, because they are, it's not that they are no cost. They're low cost relative to what we're doing and the economic value that we pull out of the Tahoe Basin. If you had a swimming pool, you would spend that much and more on an individual basis, just kind of tracking the conditions in your swimming pool so you didn't have excessive algae growth and start growing bacteria and stuff in your swimming pool. So we need to do the same thing for Tahoe.
I was wondering if we have any studies or have any studies, this is more of above the lake, but of nitric oxide from car exhaust.
Yeah, there's been quite a series of extensive studies looking at atmospheric contributions to the lake. And it was an area where there was a lot of debate for several decades, actually, about how much was coming in and then how much of it was coming in from out of the basin and how much was produced within basin. And they've concluded now, ultimately, that most of the nutrients, and most of the nitrogen, which ultimately forced the lake to shift from a phosphorus from a nitrogen limitation to a phosphorus limitation, is coming from within the basin. So we're producing it here in the basin, driving automobiles, wood burning, things like that.
More of a programmatic question. You've been talking about what you would like to be doing. So I'm sort of hearing this as a very constrained program. Is there a definition of what you would like to do for a normal program, much less stretch goals, and what that would cost?
We did not do that this time. We had done that in the past, the usual terminologies. Well, what would the Cadillac be and what would the Yugo be? All right. But everyone always buys, when you don't have any money, you always buy the Yugo. So why dream about the Cadillac? You know, it's like, it's not worth our time to develop that, because it takes a lot of effort and time to develop those programs. So we really focused on developing the bare bones kind of approach to evaluating the nearshore in a collective, integrated way that gives you the picture that allows you to do an assessment that is a complete assessment for the nearshore. And so there are a few minor things we're not looking at, but these are really the important response variables. These are the things that are going to respond sensitively and locally to changes around the nearshore. But it's a good question. We'd love to do a more comprehensive program. And in some ways we do, because if we have a monitoring program in place, like the long-term mid-lake clarity monitoring program, then as scientists we can reach out and bring in research funding from other sources and layer that on the infrastructure of what's already in place, and then do that at low cost. Whereas to do a research program without that kind of infrastructure in place to begin with, it's not attainable. So there are ways to do that.
And one more question from State Parks.
All right.
You talked about phosphorus a little bit, and I've read that aquatic macrophytes can pull phosphorus fixed out of the sediment and release it to the water column when they die and decompose. So I was wondering what your sense is of increasing aquatic invasive weed beds in Tahoe are to the phosphorus level.
I'll lead in with one answer first, and that is there weren't a lot of the macrophytes around Lake Tahoe from what we can gather historically. There are species that do grow here, not the invasive species, but local species that grow here, but they weren't prevalent around Lake Tahoe's near shore until the Eurasian milfoil came to Tahoe, and that's changed things because now we have a lot more of it around, and they would both kind of function similarly, but now we have a lot more of the invasive actually colonizing the near shore.
Is that mostly on the south shore though? The milfoil, mostly on the south shore?
There are patches in the north shore as well. I mean, there's patches just right here in Crystal Shore West marinas, but it's the big populations are probably in the South Shore, in particular like the Tahoe Keys, where you can find everything there.
Yes.
So that would be an example where you see there's a high density of invasive aquatic weeds, which you can obviously see that the clarity there is a lot different from other parts of the lake where you don't see that. But I think it's a multiple level. There's also biological, you know, fish species and all that there.
Okay.
One more quick question. Just quick, philosophically, why not? You talked about trying to figure out what people want. Where are you gonna put that bar? Why not put that bar as close to pristine as you can possibly get? Because no matter where the bar is, we're probably not gonna get it.
Well, that's the point. I think is that we would like to put it somewhere where we can achieve our goals. And so, it's sort of like designing the Cadillac. You know, why design the Cadillac if you're never gonna build it and no one's ever gonna buy it? So it's the same thing. Collectively, I mean, that's a valid perspective. And maybe there's enough actual motivation collectively, locally, to say we want it right there as close as pristine as we can get it within the range of what we think was historically relevant. And we're willing to pay for that. All right. So that's the thing. Maybe there's enough local incentive to actually do that and achieve it. But if you're not willing to commit to achieving it, then why put it there? That's my perspective. So.
If you don't ask people.
Well, on that optimistic note, and it is optimistic, and I actually agree, if you don't aim high, then you're never going to get what you want. I'd like to thank our presenters for the work they put in tonight and for the work that went into the work they presented tonight. I'd like to thank you all for coming.